Oh, there you go. All right. So can everybody hear me okay? Good stuff. Well, good morning, Provost. Thanks so much for inviting me to come back and tell another history story. I'm delighted to be here, delighted to have Sherry of Kent Books as well. You can do some business with her later. The topic today, well, you can call it a road trip in 1840. Based on my most recent book, came out in June last year, called 38 Hours to Montreal, William Weller and the Governor General's Race of 1840. 38 Hours to Montreal is the story of an amazing sleigh ride in 1840. And no, there are no jingle bells involved in this sleigh ride. The story features two primary characters. On the left here, you see William Weller. In 1840, he was already well known as the Stagecoach King. He owned and operated stagecoach lines between Toronto and Kingston with connections onto Montreal. He held contracts with the post office to deliver the Royal Mail with his stages. He lived in Cobourg, but he operated out of the General Stage Office in downtown Toronto. It was a central hub of the transportation system at that time. Remember, this is long before the railways. So steamboats on the lake and stagecoaches on the land were the public transit of the time. William Weller was often described, especially by newspaper editors, as a very enterprising gentleman. He was known as a fair and honest businessman, and just a really nice guy. Second character in the right here is Charles Thompson. He was the Governor General of the British North American colonies, therefore the most powerful man in the land. He'd been appointed as Governor General just in the previous fall, and he'd been sent to the colonies specifically to implement the recommendations of the Durham Report. His boss, Lord Durham, had come over a year before to talk to Canadians to find out what they were so annoyed about that they would actually take up arms against the Crown. The Mackenzie Rebellion was just over a year or two before. And Lord Durham's recommendations represented really serious reform of the underlying structure of government. Well, Mr. Thompson came to Toronto in early November of 1839, and he spent about 3 months passing a whole series of bills in the Parliament of Upper Canada. Now, this was serious business. The most important one was the union of Upper and Lower Canada into one province. But they also dealt with issues to change the underlying method of government. They wanted to implement what they called department-style government. It was kind of a new idea at the time. They also wanted to deal with some very contentious issues, such as divesting the land that was still held in the clergy reserves, and some cleanup, like getting rid of lifetime tenures that some folks had voted for themselves in previous years. So you can call it modernization, moving forward, whatever, but these reforms had very clear intent. They were focused on the power that was still held by that small group of elite families that even then were known as the family compound. So fast forward, first week of February in 1840, Mr. Thompson's now has finished passing all these bills in the Parliament of Upper Canada. Now, he needs to get to Montreal to do exactly the same job there. All the same bills had to be passed in the Parliament of Lower Canada as well. They were merging the two provinces, so legislation had to match. Navigation on the lakes wouldn't open for another month and a half, so he couldn't take a steamboat. His bosses were constantly complaining to him about how long this whole process was taking. They were dangling a peerage over his head, you know, in case the Queen approved of his work. And 40 years old, prime of his life, was an aggressive fellow. He's not the kind of guy who's going to wait around for the weather to get better. So a stagecoach ride was the best option. And he knew exactly who to call. So these two interesting gentlemen got together and they made a contract. And the contract stipulated that Mr. Weller must drive the Governor General and his aide-de-camp from Toronto to Montreal in under 38 hours. Or else the contract would be null and void. Mr. Weller wouldn't be paid at all. Now, on the face of it, this was an outrageous request. Nobody had ever done anything like this before, certainly not in that time frame. But Mr. Weller sat there and signed that contract with his normal optimism and confidence. Oh, there was one other matter. There was a wager on the side for £1,000. The documentation doesn't tell us exactly, but I assume it was with the Governor General. The only guy who had that kind of money, really. But imagine what kind of incentive that would have been for Mr. Weller. That's a lot of money in 1840. Well, it's a road trip, so there is a departure point and a destination point. The departure would come from Beverly House at the corner of Queen and John Street in downtown Toronto. Beverly House was owned by John Beverly Robinson, one of the most powerful men in Upper Canada at this time. He had been Chief Justice of Upper Canada since 1829. He was a member of the Executive Council. He was also known to be the de facto leader of the family compact. Now, the Robinson family wasn't in Toronto at this time. They were in England. The Chief Justice was taking the cure at Cheltenham Spa, don't you know? So when Mr. Thompson came to Toronto in November of 1839, he rented Beverly House. It was available. It was perfect. And the irony of this was not lost on anyone around Toronto. Now you had the home of the leader of the family compact was Government House. And the occupant was the one man most intent on reducing the ability of these elite families to maintain their positions of power. Oh, there were jokes about it in the newspapers and on the streets. The destination? Exchange Coffee House, near the corner of McGill and St. Paul in downtown Montreal. This would put it down close to the north shore of the river, in the, still the western part of Montreal at that time. Very popular hotel, tavern, stage stop for a number of decades. It took its name from the fact that for several decades before, a group of gentlemen from Montreal, bankers, financiers, businessmen, had held weekly meetings in the second floor of this building to conduct their trading. And over time, that group would evolve into the Montreal Exchange. So it comes by the name naturally. Mr. Thompson took rooms at this establishment when he came to Canada, and it would be his base of operations while he was there. So what kind of sleigh would they drive for this trip? I don't know. I don't have a picture for you. So we have to use our imagination a bit. There were reports from folks at the time who saw the sleigh during the trip. They said it was shaped kind of like a baby's cradle, kind of long and low and narrow. There was a hint that it might be a Russian design. And it could have been a sleigh that Mr. Thompson brought with him when he came to Canada. Because as a young man, he had spent a number of years driving around Russia and Eastern Europe working for his father's mercantile firm. This type of sleigh was designed for the cold and rough Russian steppe. They were meant for a maximum of two passengers who would recline on a mattress covered in bearskin furs. There were no seats in this sleigh. There is evidence that Mr. Weller modified the sleigh for this trip. A roof was installed in order to protect the Governor General, his aide-de-camp, from the worst of the Canadian winter weather. Metal runners were installed on the wooden runners to add a little extra durability, reliability. After all, it was the Governor General they were taking. But by all accounts, this was an odd-looking conveyance for the people and the time. And it generated as much interest in the public as the driver and the passengers. Now, in the days leading up to departure, and actually, departure date changed a couple of times until Mr. Thompson finally got all of his work done. But Mr. Weller was busy the whole time. He sent messengers on down the road with clear instructions for those folks that he had selected to perform stage stops. They were to have a two-horse team standing on the side of the road at the right time during the trip, a couple of quick-handed young fellows ready to make a fast change. Everything was oriented towards reducing delay. Mr. Weller had run stages on this road for more than a decade. He knew every hotel and tavern and blacksmith shop all along the road. There would be dozens, hundreds of people all along the road who earned part or all of their living from the public transit system of the day. And you got to think, when they heard about Mr. Weller's enterprise coming down the road, they would have been anxious to help in any way they could. And it just didn't hurt at all that Mr. Weller was known to be a nice guy, so folks wanted to help. So, 7 a.m., Monday morning, February 17th, 1840, out in the driveway in front of Beverly House, Mr. Weller cracked the whip over the heads of the horses, and the trip began. He was very careful to record the time of departure because they were on the clock, and they would need that information when they got to Montreal in order to calculate the length of the trip and to determine whether they were within the contract. Well, from Beverly House, they went down John Street and turned left onto King Street. Just at the northwest corner of King and John, they would have seen this large building back off the street. This was the Toronto Hospital, even then known as one of the best medical facilities in the colonies and the precursor of Toronto General Hospital. Mr. Weller would look down the length of King Street. It was the busiest street in the city at this time. The town of York had been incorporated as a city back in 1834 and had been named Toronto at that time. Actually, it had been renamed Toronto, because the indigenous folks had called this location Toronto long before Europeans came to this land. It meant a gathering place. But by 1840, the city was growing fast and was quickly becoming the commercial as well as the governmental center of Upper Canada. On down King Street, past Yonge to Toronto Street. Mr. Weller would have seen these two large buildings off to his left, off the road, street a little ways. The first one was the courthouse, the second one was the jail. They'd been deliberately built back off the street to create this convenient yard, and the sidewalk in this area had become a popular promenade where people would go to see and be seen in this dynamic and growing town. And right in between the two buildings, less than 2 years before, is where the gallows had been erected in order to hang Samuel Lount and Peter Matthews and put a gruesome end to the Mackenzie Rebellion. A large crowd had gathered in the yard and out in the street to witness the double public hanging. Today, there's a historical plaque there at the corner of 1 Toronto Street to commemorate that event. Next was Church Street and St. James Anglican Church. Now, the first church had been built here in 1803. But the building that Mr. Weller drove by on this day was brand new. It had just been built because the previous church had been destroyed by fire just back in December of 1838. Unfortunately, this building would be destroyed by fire in less than a decade, and it would be replaced by the magnificent structure we know of today as St. James Cathedral on King Street in Toronto. On down King Street on the south side, Mr. Weller would pass the market. This was the second market building at this location. It was built in 1831, and it would serve until 1850 when it was replaced by the much more modern, larger brick building that today we call St. Lawrence Market. Now, interestingly, in 1840, Toronto City Council held their meetings in the upstairs level of the market building. Well, on down King Street at Berkeley, the road swung to the northeast and made a beeline to the bridge over the Don River, kind of in the area of Queen Street today. And once the travelers were across the bridge, they were now on the Kingston Road, the name for the main road from Toronto to Kingston. Generally speaking, we can say that the route of the Kingston Road is number 2 highway today, but not exactly. The roads changed a lot in many places over the years. This was one of the main challenges I had in researching this story, was to determine in every little town and village, where did the road go in 1840? Well, the first stage stop of the trip was at Highland Creek, about 15 miles out from downtown Toronto. This 15 miles was considered an average distance you should drive a team of horses before changing them. It was a very common standard. So as he approached Highland Creek, Mr. Weller took out his horn, gave a loud warning, as was customary for stagecoach drivers in those days, to let folks at the stage stop know that you're going to be arriving at any moment. So when he came up to the stage stop, he saw that the proprietor there had done his job. There was a 2-horse team standing on the side of the road. A couple of young fellows made a very fast change, and in a few minutes, he was on the road again. And he must have been thinking, let's have 23 more just like that one. This is a toll booth on the Kingston Road in that period of 1840 out near the Rouge River. Now, the Kingston Road had been planked all the way from downtown Toronto to the Rouge River Valley just a couple of years before. And toll booths came along with planking in order to pay for construction and maintenance. However, all conveyances of the Crown were exempt from tolls. So Mr. Weller wouldn't have to pay any tolls on the whole trip, which isn't to say that he wasn't concerned about actually getting through the toll booths, especially some that had physical gates that had to be lifted. But again, those messengers that had been sent down the road would have talked to the proprietor of the toll booth to make sure that right time during the trip they were on the lookout for that odd-looking conveyance coming down the road, and they'd let Mr. Weller and the Governor General through without delay. At this time, the Rouge River crossing was notorious as the most dangerous place between Toronto and Kingston. The valley was narrow and steep, the river was swift. The bridge there would be damaged and washed away routinely. As a matter of fact, Mr. Weller, just back in 1836, had taken matters into his own hand when the spring freshet had completely washed away the bridge. He couldn't afford to have his stages delayed, so he hired a crew of his own on his own dime to build a new bridge over the Rouge River crossing. I have a document that shows that he requested £600 compensation from the government for this project. I don't know if he was ever actually compensated, but it shows a very serious deficiency in the government at this time for dealing with what we would call infrastructure projects. But the guy in the sleigh, Mr. Thompson, was anxious to solve this problem. His boss, Lord Durham, had identified this as a main drag on development in Upper Canada at this time. One of the departments that they would create from their reforms would be called the Board of Works. It would be responsible for infrastructure projects. It would be manned by professional civil engineers who would bring the latest technology to the work, and there would be flexible funding systems for the ever larger and more expensive projects that were coming along. Well, the sleigh headed down the Kingston Road. They went through small villages of Dunbarton and Duffins Creek, which would later make up Pickering Village. They made their second stage. Oh, and then Mr. Weller saw on the south side of the road, very familiar establishment to him. It was called the Old Post Inn even then. This building today houses a daycare center. Underwent major renovations in 2012 with an eye to maintaining the heritage aspect, both internally and externally. They did a beautiful job. So if you're going out of Ajax to the east on number 2 highway, just down a long hill on the right side, you can see this wonderful building in kind of its repurposed glory, if you will. Showing a little bit of a modern road map here. Remember, this is Kingston Road, number 2 highway. Let's forget 401 if we can for a minute. So the travelers made their second stage stop at Perry's Corners, which would later be Whitby. They galloped on through Skye's Corners, which would later be Oshawa. They went through a couple of villages, Prestonvale and Short's Corners, which would later make up Curtis. They headed on through the town of Bowmanville. And as they headed east out of Bowmanville, Mr. Weller must have had his mind wander a little bit, about 5 miles north, where the town of Orono is today. That's where his father lived. David Weller had bought a farm there. It's actually the southern part of the village of Orono today, back in the early 30s. So, as you can imagine, it was good to have family in the area. Next stage stop was at Samuel Wilmot's Tavern. It was just a little west of what was called Crandall's Corners at that time. But within a year, it would be named Newcastle. Then they galloped on through the village of Clark, which would later be called Newtonville. Next stage stop was at Marsh's Tavern. It was 3 miles west of the village of Guideboard, which would later be called Welcome. Followed the Kingston Road, turning right in Guideboard and headed on into Port Hope. Now, they weren't going to stop at Port Hope, galloping on through, but Mr. Weller may have doffed his cap at the Hastings House Hotel because his friend John Thomas Warren Hastings ran it. It was considered one of the better establishments on the Kingston Road at this time. I love, as a historian, to see a map that shows Port Hope and Cobourg all nice close together here. It's in those decades in the middle of the 1800s, these two towns would compete head-to-head, each vying for dominance in the area of trade and commerce. The movers and shakers of both towns had the same idea. They believed that if you could build a good port down at the lake, you could build good roads from the northern concessions through your town, then all those Teamster wagons loaded with lumber and wheat and all the people traffic would go right by the front doors of your hotels and taverns and blacksmith shops. Everybody in your town would make a lot of money. It was the holy grail of development for a number of decades. Many people made a lot of investments, you know, some of them successful and some of them not so much. Next, they came to Cobourg. This is where Mr. Weller lived. He'd moved his family here back in 1834. They lived out on King Street out at the East End. This painting from 1840 shows the view from the harbor. Now, there had been a major harbor project undertaken here back in 1830. They'd taken a swampy shoreline and made a serviceable harbor out of it, and then the addition of the large wharf made this into a trade and commerce facility that was the envy of towns along the north shore of Lake Ontario at the time. This also shows some of the major buildings in town at the time. Most impressive up the hill to the north here, just a few years old at this time. It was still called the Upper Canada Academy. But in the next year or so, this institution would gain full accreditation and would become Victoria College. And this was a very important step in the secularization of secondary school education in Upper Canada. Over on the right here, we see St. Peter's Anglican Church. This was the older building, been built back in the 20s. Would be replaced in another decade or so with the wonderful structures that are there today on the north side of King Street in Cobourg. Right in the middle here is the Albion Hotel. This is where Mr. Weller had his stage office in Cobourg. And in behind the Albion on Swain Street was Mr. Weller's carriage works. This was a major enterprise. They designed and manufactured and sold and traded all sorts of vehicles. You know, buggies and sleighs and Teamster wagons and stagecoaches. Think General Motors 1840s style. Well, our travelers were not stopping in Cobourg. They galloped right on through. But you can expect as they got out to the East End, Mr. Weller may have seen his wife, Mercy, and some of the kids standing along the side of the road yelling and waving as they went by. This would be, their home was in the area of, there's Cottesmore Avenue comes down to King Street there today. East of Cobourg, the next stage stop would be at Grafton. Of course, the lovely Grafton Village Inn sits there in the middle of town today. Very popular hotel, tavern, stage stop for decades before Mr. Weller went through and afterwards. East of Grafton, they would pass through the little village of Wicklow. And just a little east of Wicklow, they would encounter what was known as Harriman Hill. Harriman Hill was notorious as the worst mud hole between Toronto and Kingston. Oh, Mr. Weller would have been very familiar with it driving stages. This historical illustration by C.W. Jeffers is called Carrying a Rail. It's not Harriman Hill, but it might be. It's very close. Now, it demonstrates a common habit in the stagecoach era. This passenger has exited the stage. He's found himself a fence rail along the road, and he's trying to assist the stagecoach driver in extracting the stage from the mud. As a passenger, you were expected to help in this manner, no matter how expensive your clothing. Now, I have to remember, it's, for our travelers, it was February. So frost would still be in the ground. So we can expect Mr. Weller was able to drive right across Harriman Hill without any delay. And he headed on down Kingston Road through the village of Colburn, then Brighton. If I had lived where I live right now, I could have reached out and touched him as I went by on Main Street. The next stage stop was planned for Trent Port, which we now call Trenton. The bridge over the Trent River had been built just back in 1834, and I don't think we can underestimate the importance of this major improvement in the province-wide transportation system. Replaced a ferry that had operated there for a number of decades. Now, Mr. Weller was mainly interested in getting a good stage stop at Cyrus Weaver's Tavern, just at the east end of the bridge, and then he headed out on the bridge. Now, the western third of this bridge was open with a drawbridge to let boats through in the river. But as you can see here, the eastern two-thirds of it was covered. It was like a big barn. Now, this image is from the 19-teens, just a few years before the whole thing was torn down. So it's a little worse for wear. But boy, when this was new, it was a phenomenon. It was designed by the civil engineer, Hugh Nicol Baer, the same guy who designed the Presqu'île Point Lighthouse. Well, our travelers were across in no time, and then they were in Hastings County. They would stop for an hour in Belleville. It was considered kind of the halfway point in the trip. Mr. Wellard made arrangements with his friend Royal Monroe to have a full meal and a servicing of the sleigh and the harnesses. So the passengers exited the sleigh and entered the Mansion House Hotel, which was along Front Street here towards the east end of the bridge over the Moir River. Now this painting, as delightful as it is from 1830. So it doesn't show a lot of this construction that had happened, the development that happened in the previous years. Up the hill here a ways, there was a very large courthouse and jail complex, a very impressive Presbyterian church, some new commercial buildings along Front Street. Belleville was a dynamic and growing town at this time. However, the hour passed all too quickly, and our travelers were back on the road again, much refreshed. The next stage stop would be at Culbertson's Wharf in Tyonedega Township, a place that would later be called Deseronto, after the Mohawk chief who brought 20 families here to settle and found the Tyonedega Mohawk territory. On farther down the road, they would pass through the small village of Napanee, which had mills on both sides of the very substantial Napanee River. This river was considered one of the best in the province for water power at this time, when water power was really critical to development. 4 miles east of Napanee, this mile marker can be seen today, just off the north side of the road by a cornfield. At the time of our trip, this and a couple others that have survived were part of the brand new Kingston-Napanee macadamized road. Yes, now Mr. Weller was driving on a gravel road. The first operational gravel road in the province, and certainly the best piece of road Mr. Weller would drive on for the entire trip. Just a stone's throw east of the 4 mile marker was the next stage stop at the Frelick Tavern. Very popular hotel, tavern, stage stop, operated for a number of decades by John Frelick, a member of a large United Empire Loyalist family. And Mr. Frelick's home and tavern is still there. It's a private residence today just on the west side of the village of Morven. Now, the passenger in the sleigh, Mr. Thompson, would have been very comfortable stopping at the Frelick Tavern because it was well known as a very strong reform establishment. However, it was in direct competition with Gordania's Tavern a few miles down the road, which was Tory through and through. And this conflict took on even a little more bite because John Frelick and John Gordania, the proprietors of these two establishments, were in fact brothers-in-law. So you can imagine the table talk for these families. Kingston was still the largest city by population in the province. Military base, naval base, very busy commercial center. It was a very Tory environment as well, so Mr. Thompson was quite content to recline in the sleigh and wait for Mr. Weller to make a fast change at the Lambton Hotel. And then they hurried across the Cataraqui Bridge, which you see here. It took them across the mouth of the Cataraqui River. This bridge was also called the Penny Bridge because it cost 1 penny for a pedestrian to go across. Once they were on the east side of the river, the road from here to Montreal would be called the King's Highway. Well, they hurried down the King's Highway in the cold and dark. They went through the villages of Gananoque, Mallorytown, and then Brockville. As they approached Prescott, Mr. Weller must have had a flood of memories coming back because this was his first home in Upper Canada. It's where he got started in the stagecoach business. As a young man, he'd grown up at the town of Canton, New York, southeast of Prescott. In the late 20s, he'd come into partnership with Hiram Norton of Prescott for a small stage line. A couple years later, Mr. Weller took it over himself, and he was on his way. Prescott was a very prosperous place at this time due to what they called the forwarding trade. Prescott was located at the west end of the rapids in the St. Lawrence River. It's where steamboat passengers would disembark and take the wagons and stages in order to avoid the rapids. So from Cornwall to Prescott, the forwarding trade flourished in those years before the canals were built in the St. Lawrence River. Forwarders Museum in Water Street in Prescott is actually located in an original forwarder's warehouse, provides the modern visitor with a fascinating glimpse into the past. Well, I headed on down the King's Highway, went through the little village of Edwardsburg, which would later be named Cardinal, through the village of Iroquois, then a little place called Mariatown that would later be called Morrisburg. Then our travelers would pass through several villages, which much later in time, up into the 1950s, would become known as the Lost Villages. The flooding of the St. Lawrence Seaway in 1958 would submerge several villages along the north shore of the river. This map shows dark blue in the middle is the original river before the flooding of the Seaway. And the light blue on the outside shows the extent of the flooding for the Seaway. The dotted line across the north shore shows the route of number 2 highway at the time of the flooding of the Seaway. I'm sure you've all seen those pictures, right? With the road disappearing down into the water. Well, for our purposes today, that is more or less the King's Highway in 1840. This also shows the two new villages that were created at the time of the Seaway, Ingleside and Long Sioux. You know, many people with their homes and their businesses were physically picked up from the old villages and moved before the flooding up to found these two new towns. And a new version of number 2 was moved farther north to link them up. So when Mr. Weller came through here in February of 1840, he would first come to a small village called Charlesville, which would later be called Altsville. It's considered to be the first of the lost villages from the west. Then a significant village called Farran's Point. There was a few other small burgs along the way. The largest of the lost villages was Dickinson's Landing right here. It was a very busy commercial center since early settlement times. And a couple of other villages off to the east, Moulinet and Mille Roche. Today, there's a lovely drive here. It's called the Long Sioux Parkway. It comes off number 2 just east of Ingleside, goes across to the village of Long Sioux, goes across causeways, and it crosses the islands that were created by the flooding of the Seaway. And if you look closely, you can see along here, this row of islands is more or less the north shore of the old river. I found it very frustrating here. I drove back and forth and stopped, pulled out my maps and all my information. I couldn't, for the life of me, visualize Dickinson's Landing in 1840. The environment has just so dramatically changed. If you're in the area, though, please have a look at Lost Villages Museums off number 2 here east of Long Sioux. It has lots of interesting pictures and stories about the lost villages and the flooding of the Seaway. Well, now Mr. Weller is anxious to make a stage stop in Cornwall. His friend John Chesley operates a very popular hotel, tavern, stage stop towards the west end of town. Today, Chesley's Inn is a lovely and well-run bed and breakfast. Now, the frame building at this location that Mr. Weller stopped at was bricked up in the 1860s when it became private residence. And in recent years, this building was literally saved from destruction and with major renovations has become, well, first-class auberge, as they call it. During my research, I was able to stay a couple of nights at this establishment, and I can certainly recommend it as an experience in comfort as well as just a charming step back into the past. In 1840, Cornwall was in deep recession. And just as recently as 1834 or 36, there'd been a big boom going on when they began to build the first of the major canals, the Cornwall Canal. So lots of employment, lots of investment, great times. Then the Mackenzie Rebellion hit. Government funds dry up. The work just stops. They were about 80% complete. Well, this was a disaster for Cornwall. Lost employment, lost investment. It was terrible. So when Mr. Weller went through here in February of 1840, down there south of Water Street in Cornwall, all he would have seen was a big, ugly ditch full of mud. And that situation wasn't resolved for another 2 years, 1842. After the Board of Works had been created through Mr. Thompson's reforms, funding was put back in place to finish the Cornwall Canal. And this ushered in a century of progress and development for Cornwall. A big industrial area grew up there between the canal and the river. Oh, it's all gone now. It's a lovely park and museum there. But it really meant a major progress for Cornwall and the area. Well, now Mr. Weller is anxious to get east out of Cornwall, heads through the little village of Lancaster, and pretty soon enters Lower Canada. Sensing the time ticking away, he keeps up the pace through the small villages, Saint-Zotique, Coteau de Lac, Les Cedres, onto the point at Cascades. Of course, he keeps to the main road. Now, the locals in this area call it the Montreal Road, obviously, because you're getting close to Montreal. Up the western channel of the Ottawa River to Vaudreuil, across on the ice to the large island of Ile Perrot, across on the ice again, and now they're on the north shore of Lake St. Louis, even closer to Montreal. The second last stage of the trip would be on the ice to Lachine. Ice roads were very common in Quebec at this time. They were critical transportation routes during the cold winter months. And Mr. Weller would have solid ice all the way across the north shore of Lake St. Louis. Pretty soon, the horses would dig in at the shoreline at Lachine. Lachine was a dynamic transportation communication center at this time, focused around the Lachine Canal, which we can still see today. This had opened in 1825. It was really the funnel between Upper and Lower Canada for all the trade goods and people traffic. Of course, on this day, Mr. Weller isn't concerned with that. He's interested in getting down Boulevard Saint-Joseph, which still today runs along the north side of the canal. He headed out of Lachine to the east, soon met up with the Montreal Turnpike, which was the main road going into Montreal from the west. Still a dirt road, but plans were on the books already to macadamize it in the next couple years. Well, Mr. Weller maneuvered very carefully around the very busy late afternoon city streets in West Montreal, and soon he came to a wide boulevard, and he turned right, and he was on McGill Street. He came down McGill Street, almost to St. Paul, and he pulled out his horn and gave a loud warning because he knew that the destination, the Exchange Coffee House, was right here in the middle of this complex of buildings within earshot. Now, the folks at the Exchange Coffee House wouldn't have to prepare another team of horses because the trip was at an end. But Mr. Weller, as you can imagine, was cold and tired, and he wanted to make sure everybody in town knew that the Governor General would arrive at any moment. He continued down McGill Street, turned left onto St. Paul, and as he approached the small alley that was the access into the Exchange Coffee House, he prepared to turn left again. Well, it was a precarious little entrance into this long alley that led up to the courtyard in front of the Exchange Coffee House. Stagecoach drivers had traditionally made dramatic entrances into this little alley, you know, mostly for show. Well, Mr. Weller turned into the alley, pushed the team hard, and when he came into the courtyard, swung the team around, and the sleigh stopped a few feet from the front door. Mr. Weller announced, "The Exchange Coffee House Governor, at your service." Finally, the trip was at an end. This report first appeared in the Montreal Courier, and later in the Cobourg Star on February 26th. It is the most complete and accurate of all the reports I've found in the archives about this event. I actually want to read part of it, so feel free to follow along. In noticing the arrival of the Governor-in-Chief, we may mention that Mr. Weller engaged to convey His Excellency from Toronto to Montreal, a distance of 376 miles in 38 hours. They started at 7 o'clock on Monday morning and arrived at 20 minutes before 7 on Tuesday evening, being 35 hours and 40 minutes on the way and 2 hours and 20 minutes within the contract. The horses were changed 24 times, and the whole of the stoppages amounted to about 5 hours. His Excellency, accompanied by his civil secretary, rode in one sleigh drawn by 2 horses. Well, when Mr. Thompson got to Montreal, he set right to work. And within a few months, he was able to pass all the bills he needed in the Parliament of Lower Canada. In August of that year, Mr. Thompson finally got his peerage. And from that time on, he was known as Lord Sydenham, or more correctly, Baron Sydenham of Sydenham in Kent and Toronto in Canada. In early February of 1841, this union of Upper and Lower Canada finally took effect. And so now you just had the province of Canada with one legislature, equal representation for Canada East, which would later be Quebec, and Canada West, which would later be Ontario. Unfortunately, this union would turn out to be a bit of a political disaster. It resulted in parliamentary gridlock, which even the advent of responsible government a decade later couldn't resolve. This was the situation that Johnny MacDonald and George Brown and their associates encountered in the 1850s and 60s, which led happily for us to Confederation. On the other hand, many of Mr. Thompson's reforms at this time proved to be very effective. The Board of Works would go on and build roads and bridges and canals and ultimately railways. This department-style government they implemented would prove to be very effective as it evolved through time. On balance, I think we can thank Lord Sydenham for his efforts. And I'm pretty sure he would have been very happy to know that over time, the family compact kind of faded away into history. Sadly, Lord Sydenham didn't live to see his home again. In July of 1841, his health deteriorated and he was forced to resign his position as Governor General. He planned to go back to England. But then in September, in Kingston, he had a riding accident. He fell and broke his leg. It became infected. And within a few days, he was dead. Lord Sydenham was buried with fitting ceremony beneath St. George's Cathedral in Kingston. But even at his death, the Tories just couldn't contain themselves. His old landlord in Toronto, John Beverly Robinson, was heard to say, "That despicable Thompson." Well, before Mr. Weller headed back to Cobourg, the Governor General invited him to Government House in Montreal, and he was presented with a beautiful gold watch, with a lovely inscription on the back and a mahogany case. Now, that gold watch has survived in the Weller family. It exists today. I've actually seen it, although the owner prefers to remain anonymous. Mr. Weller went back to Cobourg. Boy, I hardly had time for a breath. Unusually warm weather that spring meant that navigation on the lakes would open 3 weeks earlier than normal. Boy, if you were driving stagecoaches, that was a big deal. All the stage lines had to be prepared to make connections with each other, to make connections with the steamboats. All the Royal Mail contracts had to be finalized and the resources put in place to meet the stringent terms of those contracts. Well, Mr. Weller would have had a very busy few months. Later that year, Mr. Weller would purchase a piece of property just off to the east of Cobourg. And his father, David Weller, would live there until he passed away in 1851. Now, it's just speculation on my part. But it could be that that's how Mr. Weller decided to utilize the proceeds from the wager, you know, the £1,000, which he won. Anyway, I'm just saying it's possible. William Weller would have much success in his life, but driving the Governor General to Montreal in 1840, in record time, would always be seen as his single greatest accomplishment. It made his reputation as the stagecoach king. Well, that's a road trip in 1840, folks. Glad to have the Kent Books people here. The old book, Murder in the Family, is here. New book, 38 Hours to Montreal. They are also available in the bookstores and online, ebook versions for both, if you're so inclined. And feel free to look at my website, Dan Buchanan History Guy, for any other information. That's a road trip in 1840, folks. Thanks so much for your attention.